Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a huge unicycle event is coming here to Wisconsin. We'll find out what it's like to ride on just one wheel.
First, a gunman opened fire at a Louisiana movie theater last night, killing two people and wounding nine others, according to local police.
3 years ago this week, another gunman, James Holmes, opened fire in a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. He was convicted on Thursday of murdering 12 people.
Last night's shooting in Louisiana came shortly after President Obama told the BBC that he's frustrated over gun laws in the U.S. Here's the president.
If you ask me where has been the one area where I feel that I've been most frustrated and most stymied, it is the fact that the United States of America is the one advanced nation on earth in which we do not have sufficient common sense gun safety laws, even in the face of repeated mass killings. And, you know, if you look at the number of Americans killed since 9/11 by terrorism, it's less than 100. If you look at the number that have been killed by gun violence, it's in the tens of thousands.
Robert Spitzer is with us now. He's a distinguished service professor and chair of the Political Science Department at the State University of New York at Cortland. He's the author of a new book on gun policy. It's called Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
Well, President Obama there saying gun reform is his biggest piece of unfinished business. And at this point in his term, is there any chance that he'd be able to accomplish anything on that issue?
The answer is no, at least not with respect to any action by Congress. Congress, of course, is firmly in the hands of the opposing political party, and that alone is sufficient reason to indicate why Congress is not likely to act on this subject. The Republican Party, of course, is much more friendly to the gun rights side, and that aside, the leaders and Republicans in Congress are not disposed to work with Obama on much of any issues right now, this being the last 18 months of his presidency, and the gun issue is contentious enough that even under optimal political circumstances, it's difficult to enact. So while there might be some minor administrative tinkering by the Obama administration, perhaps a new executive order or something, there will be no significant national action on the gun issue.
Right. So in terms of legislation with Congress, no, but you mentioned executive action. Do you expect anything to happen on that front?
Well, I know of nothing coming down the pike, so to speak. After the shooting in Connecticut at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, President Obama, of course, proposed new legislation to Congress in early 2013 and also did issue a series of executive orders and directives to improve researching on gun violence and to do some other things. So that was indicative of the type of thing that he could do acting on his own. But here again, those actions were relatively limited in scope, and perhaps there is some other kind of activity that he or members of his administration are contemplating, but I know of none as of now.
And over the last 6 years, has the president been making a strong and sustained political push for gun reform? Or do you think he has seen this as something that's a front he's not going to win on, and so he's been putting it on the back burner?
Well, he has not been pushing the gun issue. In his first term, I mean, even going back to the 2008 presidential election, it was clear that he was a supporter of stronger gun laws, but it was also clear that it was not a front burner issue for him or his campaign. After he became president, he really paid the gun issue little attention, partly for the obvious reason that he had his hands full with the economy and a plethora of other issue concerns. And in fact, one of the pro-gun control groups, the Brady Coalition, gave him a failing grade on his handling of the gun issues in his first term. But then along came the Sandy Hook shooting in December of 2012, right after the election, and he felt at that moment that it was the right thing to do, and so of course he moved ahead with a pretty concerted effort on his part, but it did fall short in the U.S. Senate.
Now, in that clip we heard of the president talking to the BBC, he said there was insufficient common sense gun safety legislation in the United States. What did he mean by that, do you think? What sorts of laws is he referencing?
Well, that is generally a reference to, for example, establishing nationwide uniform background checks for all gun purchases. If you obtain a gun, if you purchase a gun from a federally licensed firearms dealer, there is a background check that one undergoes, but by rough estimates, from 30 to 40% of all gun exchanges in America do not include background checks. So a great many guns are trafficked, and I don't mean to suggest most of them are involved in crimes by any means, but there's a great many guns that are exchanged every year for which there is no record, and that's a gaping hole in the existing law that certainly could be addressed by legislation. Certainly more could be done in terms of pairing good data about people with certain types of mental illness and restricting their access to guns. The shooter in Lafayette, Louisiana, who shot up the movie theater last night, had, according to his family, a history of manic depression and bipolar, and those would seem to be pretty clear, you know, kinds of mental disorders whereby you would not want people with those problems to have access to guns, but he did. In fact, his wife, that he had guns in his home earlier on, and his wife removed them from the home because she was so concerned about what he might do. But it never got to the point of him making his way, as far as I know at least, making his name onto a list, the federal list that said these are people who should not have guns. And that's a problem all over the country. And one indication of the fact is that of this is the fact that many of the people who commit mass shootings have significant mental problems, including James Holmes in Colorado from 2012, but they were able to obtain guns legally just because of the very poor way that we gather data and report it when it comes to people with these sorts of problems.
We're talking right now with Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor at SUNY Cortland. He's the author of the book Guns Across America. And you talked about the president probably referring there to national gun law, background checks, that kind of thing. Is there movement in that front at the state level? What have we seen there?
There's been a lot of action at the states, and we often lose sight of that because the federal government gets most of our attention. But especially in the wake of the failure of the federal government to act in early 2013, we saw vigorous action in pretty much every state legislature. Roughly a dozen states enacted stronger gun laws, especially in the year after the Sandy Hook shooting. However, about twice as many states enacted measures that had the effect of weakening gun laws or making it somewhat easier to get guns, although those measures tended to be fairly minor, for example, allowing judges to carry guns into courtrooms and things like that. But it was an indication of the fact that there was much desire and press for action on the gun issue. And often when the federal government fails to act, we see an explosion of action at the state level. And that's really what happened in the year and a half following the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting.
And we heard the president saying there are tens of thousands of Americans killed by gun violence compared to less than 100 by terrorism since 9/11. Can you give us some updated statistics on the numbers of people killed by gun violence?
Well, sure. On an annual basis, roughly 30,000 Americans are killed annually by gun violence, around 10,000 or so by gun homicides, and perhaps even more significantly, twice as many, roughly 20,000 per year, killed by gun suicide. That is a problem that often does not get adequate attention because there is no interpersonal weapon that's more likely to result in a successful suicide than a firearm, and no weapon easier to use. And the medical community knows well that there's a very strong link between the presence of guns and suicides, and there are less than about 1,000 gun accidents, fatal accidents each year as well. So in terms of the actual problems caused by guns and gun access, it's noteworthy that significantly more people are killed through gun suicide than gun homicide each year, even though gun homicide itself is an important problem.
And what about mass shootings like the one we saw in Louisiana?
Well, mass shootings represent a very small percentage of all gun deaths in America on a given year. However, they certainly garner a great deal of attention. There's been some recent studying done by some media outlets that demonstrate that the number of mass shootings is almost certainly underreported because really there is no single entity that conducts a uniform and unifying count of mass shootings in America, but they certainly are a significant problem, and they do often involve weapons with great firepower, semi-automatic assault weapons, handguns with large capacity bullet magazines, and they also often involve people with significant mental problems, and we know that from many of the most highly publicized mass shootings in recent times, including, of course, the one just yesterday in Lafayette, Louisiana. So they are not a problem to be ignored. It does suggest that there is more we could do to stem mass shootings, but it seems they occur in greater frequency than many people have thought.
Now, according to some polls in the last few years, a majority of NRA members support particular gun reform measures, things like universal background checks. Is there room for compromise on measures like that for the NRA and for other gun rights organizations?
Well, there is on the merits of the questions that are raised. It, just as you point out, most gun owners, in fact, once you get past their initial wariness of the idea of gun laws and you talk to gun owners, which I certainly have done over the years, you find that in many respects they have tougher attitudes about how weapons should be obtained and the circumstances under which they should be kept, training that should be that should occur for people who own guns and things like that, precisely because legitimate gun owners find their reputation sullied when somebody misuses firearms, either accidentally or maliciously. And on the merits, there certainly are readily seen compromise positions that could be found, but the National Rifle Association in particular and some other gun groups as well have gotten to a point where they simply dig in their heels and resist any and every form of gun measure that is being debated. As late as the late 1990s, for example, the NRA supported uniform background checks across the country. And in earlier decades, the NRA supported other gun measures too, but they've become more hardline, more intransigent, and they've kind of painted themselves into a corner such that they find themselves automatically opposing pretty much any kind of gun law that comes down, or gun law idea, or proposal that comes down the pike.
Robert, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
That was Robert Spitzer from the State University of New York at Cortland talking about President Obama's comments on gun laws this week. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up this time of year, there's a bounty of fresh produce. We'll talk to a Food Friday regular who says there's more than one way to slice and serve a cucumber.
First, the North American Unicycling Convention and Championships are coming to Wisconsin starting tomorrow.
The event takes place in Madison. It features on- and off-road racing, unicycle sports like basketball and hockey, and lessons for beginners.
Katie Belfast joins us now. She's vice president of Madison Unicyclists. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Scott Wilton of Madison. He's a five-time unicycling world champion, and he set two world records last year at the Unicycling World Championships in Montreal, Canada. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, Katie, how big an event is this that we're looking forward to here?
We're expecting, I think we have 225 competitors from 25 states and four Canadian provinces, and we have a couple of international guests coming in as well. So lots of folks riding unicycles and hopefully learning to ride unicycles this week, too.
And are we in the midst, would you say, of a unicycle surge or renaissance?
Well, I think we definitely have a growing active club in Madison. The club was founded probably 5 or so years ago now, and it has grown a lot, largely because a main focus of our work is working with schools to run school programs to help school children learn how to ride. And so that's, of course, grown a big cadre of folks who unicycle in our community.
Is Canada big into unicycling? I've noticed that Scott was there last year, and you also mentioned Canada as people coming down. Is it bigger in Canada than it is here?
It is the North American Unicycling Championships, and so we have to include our friends to the north, and we're really glad they come down for that. Last year, there was an international championship held in Montreal, Canada. That moves around the world. Every other year, there's an international competition.
Well, Scott, let's talk about you, a world champion in unicycling. How did you get into it?
I got started when I was about 10 years old. My mom got me a unicycle for myself and my sister, and it kind of sat around for a bit. We tried to ride and didn't really get anywhere until I really put some time into it one weekend and got the feeling of what it's like to actually go somewhere, and it kind of just moved on from there.
It's one of those things that always amazes me. It seems like you're defying the laws of physics to be able to do it at all. How do you actually balance yourself? Are there words to describe how you can learn how to do this?
A lot of it is just putting the time in. You can kind of start to get a feel for it, how sitting on top of that little pendulum point, what that feels like. But most of it's just putting the time in. There's a couple tips that we can give, and that's what we like to do at our club practices. But other than that, it's all about what you can do yourself.
So what are those couple of tips if someone wants to pick up a unicycle?
Biggest one is you always want to look forward, because if you're going to look down, that's the direction you're going.
All right, looking forward. And Katie, you said you're just learning and you'll be maybe competing this weekend, but how is it going for you right now? Are you finding that pendulum point?
Well, it's definitely easier for kids. Both of my sons unicycle. I have a 7-year-old and a 12-year-old, and they picked it up way faster than I did. But they also put in a lot more time. It has a lot to do, as Scott said, with really putting the time in on the unicycle. I was really good friends with a wall for a very long time and practicing along a wall. But holding hands with another person who's either walking or riding a unicycle next to you, a more experienced rider, is a really excellent way where you can just balance a little bit off that other person and get the feel in your body.
And Scott, one of the records that you set is for a marathon that's 26.2 miles in less than an hour and 20 minutes. What is it like riding a unicycle in a race that's that long?
It's a lot like a bicycle race. You have to train for the distance. You have to have food with you and water. A lot of us ride with hydration packs on our backs, since there's not really a spot to put a water bottle on the unicycle. And there's drafting tactics. There's mental game, really pushing yourself and holding yourself mentally. So it's like any sort of challenging athletic event.
Now, I heard you saying that you rode over here to the interview on a bicycle, not a unicycle. So what's the difference? If I can ride a bicycle, can I ride a unicycle, or does it not work like that?
It totally works like that. It's just like learning a bike. It's just the only difference is most people don't remember when they learned how to ride a bike. They were too young. You just have to put the time in, and they are different, but they feel quite similar. One misconception is if you can ride your bike no-handed, you're ready to go unicycle, and it doesn't really help you, but everyone's ready to give it a try.
All right, well, that's good news for me. I don't know if I'll try it, but it's good news. We're talking right now about the North American Unicycling Convention and Championships kicking off tomorrow in Madison, talking with Katie Belfis, Vice President of Madison Unicyclists, and Scott Wilton, 5-time unicycling world champion. And Katie, tell us a little bit about the events, because it's not just people riding unicycles. There's a lot of different components here. What can people see?
People can see so much. When my family first got involved, I had no idea, and I think that's true for many of our listeners. They can see, as Rob mentioned, there's basketball, there's hockey, floor hockey, there's events called freestyle, which involve, you know, choreography and dancing, sort of dance kinds of moves. There's stuff that folks might think of like skateboarding, except instead of a skateboard, they're using a unicycle, so they're jumping off of obstacles and over things on a unicycle. So really a huge variety of different kinds of events. And we'll be in a lot of different locations throughout the city. We'll be at Goodman Community Center this weekend. There's a 10K around the Arboretum, so if folks are familiar with that route, you know, that's a great place to come and check that out. Winnequa School over in Monona. And we'll end up in our neighborhood, the Tenny Lapham neighborhood, where we'll have a couple of events on Saturday, August 1st.
And you said you're getting kids involved in this. This is something that seems like it's sort of big in Madison among kids. How can kids get started?
Well, we offer, our club offers, every other week we have practices at Goodman Community Center and sometimes up in Sun Prairie at the gymnasium there as well. And as I said, we had a couple of school programs around, so if there's folks who are interested in starting a program at their school, we can help provide some training and equipment to help support that if there's a person at the school who's willing to take on the actual running and teaching of the club there at the school. So that's been a big, huge reason for our growth.
And let's talk about that equipment. Scott, what does it take to get started? Obviously a unicycle, but I imagine there are different kinds of them, different price ranges. What do you need to know?
There's all sorts of different sizes and kinds of unicycles. It's just like how there's different kind of bikes. You have a mountain unicycle that you can use off-road. You have ones that you can use for racing. And you also have your basic one that you get started with, and that's usually a 20-inch wheel, which is kind of like what you would see on a kid's bike. And that one can be bought for $150 or less, so it's really an accessible sport to anyone.
Do people kind of trick out their unicycles like they might other things?
Absolutely. People have custom colors. They get pedals with different colors on it. You can put your own kind of touch to however you want to do it.
And what is your, do you have more than one unicycle?
Just one? I definitely do. Once you kind of get into it, you have a whole quiver. And I have many unicycles that I use for all sorts of different types of competitions. So like the one I use for the off-road competition has a mountain bike tire on it. And it's got a nice cushy seat for when I'm riding distances. The one I use for racing, I have a longer handlebar. So I can actually kind of bend over and get in a more aerodynamic position.
Now, a lot of people can ride bicycles, but they might be thinking, you know, unicycle, it looks neat, but why should I ride it? What is the allure for you about riding a unicycle?
For me, it's a really special feeling to just be on one wheel and on one point above the ground. It's something you don't get on a bicycle, and I ride a bicycle as well, and I really enjoy it. But the way that you can turn on a unicycle is really different because you're only on one point on the ground. You can turn around things really fast. It's fun when you're riding off-road because you can jump on a unicycle quite easily compared to a bicycle. And so it has different advantages, and it's really a nice special feeling, and you really feel connected to the unicycle because if you do one thing wrong, you're back on your feet.
And Katie, what about you, just briefly, as a newbie, what do you love about it?
I love the people that it's connected me to. It's been a really great opportunity, both here in Madison at these national championships and at the international championships. There could not be a nice group of people so supportive and encouraging, and it's really, I like to have my family involved with that kind of folks.
Well, Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Scott, thank you for coming up here.
Thanks so much.
That was Katie Belfast, Vice President of Madison Unicyclists, and Scott Wilton, five-time Unicycling World Champion, and the North American Unicycling Convention and Championships kick off tomorrow in Madison.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Summer's a time for a lot of fresh produce from gardens and farmers markets, and cucumbers are starting to come up in droves. So what do we do with them all?
Food Friday regular Lori Skelton has been on a mission over the last couple weeks to experiment with cucumbers in the kitchen, from soups to cocktails to sautéing them. She's here to share some of what she learned.
And we're taking your calls, too. What is your favorite way to serve cucumber? What's your favorite cucumber recipe? And what do you think is the best variety of cucumber? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori Skelton is one of WPR's in-house foodies. She joins us once a month on Food Friday. Lori, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I've got some cucumbers nearing the point where I could actually pick them if I can beat the squirrels to them this year.
Good luck.
And I tend to think, okay, I'm going to slice them up and eat them, or I'm going to slice them up and put them on a salad. Versatility is not a word I usually associate with cucumbers. You are proving me wrong.
Well, I can understand why you're thinking something cool and refreshing and easy, because that is what cucumbers are the best at. They are a summer food. As far back, I found out, as Mesopotamia. They're mentioned in Gilgamesh.
Wow.
There are references to the Roman Emperor Tiberius having cucumbers on the table every summer evening as part of the meal. So we're used to thinking of them as something refreshing and easy in the summer. But I was having a lot of fun playing with other ways, mostly because I've discovered that there is this really strong divide in Wisconsin when it comes to what I thought was the simplest thing of all, cucumber salad for the summer, where you slice up your cucumbers the night before, salt them down to get out some of the water, and then you dress them the next day, as my mother always did, with a little bit of sugar and onion and half and half. And then I discovered that about 50% of the cooks in Wisconsin think that's heresy. You never put cream on your cucumber salad. And of course, the other 50% says, what do you mean you only use vinegar? That's not the way to go. So even there, you've got a little bit of
controversy.
And certainly it comes down to tradition in this state, because that's the way my mama did it and her mama did it. And so you can get quite fun in the kitchen, having a great time experimenting.
Well, we're using the word cucumber as though there's just one, but it turns out there's a whole bunch of different kinds of cucumbers, varieties. What did you find about the different kinds?
We think of the cucumber is technically known as a garden or a slicing cucumber. If you find it in the farmer's market, you don't need to worry about it. If you get it from the grocery store, this is going to have some wax on it probably to keep it from losing its moisture. So this is the reason why so many recipes with cucumbers say peel them. If you can get them from the farmer's market, you may not have to peel them. The peel is where all the vitamin A is. It's also where some of the bitter taste comes from. So if you don't want the bitter taste, yes, go ahead and peel them. Or you can look for something like an English or Persian cucumber. These are longer, thinner. If they're sold in the grocery store, English cucumbers are the ones that are wrapped in plastic, again, to keep them from losing water. These have very mild flavor. You don't necessarily have to peel or seed them. But those are the cucumbers that don't make very good pickles. You want those for fresh eating only. If you're looking to pickle, you want pickling cucumbers or Kirby cucumbers. They can vary in length. They will always be bumpy. Range of green colors. Yes, they're nice eating raw, but these are firm. These are crunchy. These make really great long-term pickles. Now, if you've ever seen a cucumber that looks like a big yellow tennis ball, that's known as a lemon cucumber. It's yellow, it's round, it's very sweet, no bitter edge. It's nice in salads. This one is great for doing a quick pickle that you're not going to keep for very long, or it's great chopping up with other fruit.
Like watermelon, I can imagine.
Watermelon is great. Any melon. Mango is marvelous. So are strawberries.
Ooh.
Cucumbers and strawberries are an amazing combination. This month's Bon Appetit magazine even has a recipe for a cucumber strawberry salad with a light lemon dressing.
Talking to Lori Skelton on this week's edition of Food Friday, making some new and exciting recipes with the cucumber. And let's get into the recipe we've got on the Central Time Facebook page, Lori. A spicy soup in cucumber cups. This was, I had not seen cucumbers used this way ever. Not even in my wildest dreams, Lori.
Today is National Tequila Day. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to have a little bit of fun with your tequila shooters this afternoon, get a cucumber, slice it thickly, and then hollow out some of the seeds so it looks like a shot glass. Put your tequila in that, take your shot of tequila, and then eat the cucumber. Same idea with serving soup in cucumber cups. I've seen this done before. I've had it as a past appetizer at a party. And a lot of the time, it's always a cold soup. And a lot of the time, it's been a mild cold soup, like a vichyssoise, or even a chilled cucumber soup, or watercress. Watercress was got me thinking, cucumbers go so well with hot and spicy things. So why not come up with a hot, spicy kind of soup? And I did a little bit of research, including going to the Greens Cookbook from the vegetarian restaurant in San Francisco, and I came up with my own version of a Catalan pepper tomato soup that you could serve cold, but it had enough heat to it that I thought would make a really great contrast with that lovely, fresh, refreshing cucumber. What we discovered when we were trying this out here on 7th Floor is that you do have to be careful with your cucumber cups. No matter how carefully you scoop them out, sometimes they do have actual holes where the seeds are. And so sometimes you do have a bit of a leakage problem. But in general, I was told that the concept worked really, really well. I just needed to bring in a few more cucumbers to make certain that they weren't all leaking. Several other people suggested that you use a cucumber cup for ceviche, which I thought was a great idea. I have always loved cucumbers as either substituting for a cracker or using the cup version for any kind of spicy seafood salad. Think smoked trout and salmon with sriracha, or crab with wasabi, or anything with horseradish would be a really great combination with cucumber.
Does that cucumber flavor infuse into the soup at all? Or is it just that you munch on it afterwards?
It's that you munch on it afterwards. Cucumber is mild enough that the short amount of time that your soup is going to be sitting in that little cucumber cup, there's really not a lot of time for the flavors to transfer. For this specific recipe, I really was looking for the contrast. Spicy soup that can be served cold, and then the cold cucumber as your after effect.
I was thinking gazpacho. That's probably pretty similar to your Catalan soup.
Exactly. The thing with gazpacho for me is my favorites are always chunky. And yes, I know you can come up with blended gazpachos. I've never had a gazpacho that was this spicy, however. So that to me was one of the really nice things about this particular soup. What this recipe recommended was low and slow. You warm the herbs with the olive oil before you start adding the vegetables. And, I mean, just barely bring it to a boil. When you add the last of your vegetables, you knock it back to the barest of simmers. And so this really takes its time. And I think that's one of the ways that the heat can develop and stick around. What I did find is that, like any soup, it is so much better the next day. So if you've got the time and you want to try this, see if you can make the soup a day or two ahead of when you want to serve it. And then right before you serve it, that's when you haul out the cucumbers and fill them with the soup.
Nice.
And the soup recipe itself seems pretty straightforward, not too labor intensive. The work here is going to be making the cucumber cups.
And that does take a little bit of time. Actually, it would be a really great project if you've got kids. That would be something they would just adore doing, helping you make that.
Now, leaving the kids behind now, you experimented with some cucumbers and cocktails. What did you do there?
Well, all right, if I can get back to the kids for a moment. When you are scooping out the seeds of a cucumber and you've got this lovely pile of Cucumber guts,
yes. I think we would call them.
Okay. You throw the cucumber guts in a blender with some lime juice, some fresh grated ginger, and some honey or simple syrup to taste. Blend that up and then freeze it. And that makes the greatest popsicle for a kid in the summer.
Now that sounds good.
Okay. So now that the children have their popsicles, now it's time for the adults to have their beverages. Start off with the simplest agua fresca, which is standard for any spa experience. Big pitcher of water with ice and cucumber and some citrus. You can blend that and strain it and have a really thick and very intensely flavored water. But if you want, start off with a 750 milliliter bottle of vodka or gin. Peel and slice a cucumber. You don't necessarily have to seed it. Stick the cucumber in the bottle of alcohol. Give it at least 3 days in a cool, dark place to infuse. And then your basic recipe, if you're using it in a highball glass, take some herbs that are sharper. Think basil, chervil, cilantro. Muddle that with a lemon or lime slice in the bottom of your highball glass. Add your ice. Then put in your cucumber-infused booze and top it off with seltzer or club soda or tonic water. You want to look a little fancy while you're doing this? Take simple syrup, again, which is one part sugar to one part water, boiled until the sugar dissolves. Infuse that with some sweeter herbs like hyssop or lemon balm or tarragon. You take your syrup, one part syrup, two parts of a fruit juice, lemon or melon or pineapple if you've got it, and then four parts cucumber booze. Put that in your cocktail shaker, shake it up with some ice, and strain it into a martini glass.
Ooh, fancy.
And I don't have it. I don't know where you can get it, but I'm told that Celray soda, Celray tonic, Dr. Brown's, it shows up in a lot of delicatessens, especially on the East Coast. You can get it through Amazon. And I'm told Celray tonic or Celray soda is really great with cucumber booze.
We're talking to Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about cucumbers and some creative ways to cook or drink with them. One of them, summer's most, she says, versatile vegetables, it turns out.
And we want to hear from you on this. How do you like to serve cucumbers that you get from your farmer's market, your garden, the grocery store? What's your favorite variety? And do you have flavors that you typically like to combine that go especially well to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
More Food Friday coming up after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now this Food Friday with our own Lori Skelton about what to do with all the cucumbers coming up in the garden.
You can call in now with your favorite recipes or questions about cooking with cucumbers. Do you ever use them in cocktails and other beverages? What flavors do you mix with cucumbers? What's your favorite way to make the standby, the cucumber salad? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller now. We've got Jackie on the line in Milwaukee. Jackie, hi.
Hi. My favorite way is a very simple thing, because I just use red wine vinegar, one part red wine vinegar, 2.5 parts water, sliced onion, sliced and peeled cucumber, whole peppercorn, garlic, and some other spices if you like, and then just refrigerate it for 8 hours, and it makes an absolutely delicious snack.
Now, is this one to just keep around the house, Jackie, or is this one you serve at the family get-togethers?
I've served it at church lunches and stuff like that, but because with the red wine vinegar, it does turn out kind of nice looking. But also, I keep her on house. Just I enjoy it as a snack for me.
Sounds great, Jackie.
This is the first time I've ever heard of anybody adding water, which is an interesting, because like I say, with my mom's old salad, she always salted it down first to draw a lot of that water out. So, yes, this just adding to the refreshment, especially if you can keep this in the refrigerator, just grab a couple of slices whenever you're feeling a little bit parched. That's a great idea.
Thanks so much for that call. And we're going to go next to Janine in Antioch, Illinois. Hi, Janine.
Hello. I have a question about eating cucumbers and tomatoes together. I've heard that you should not do that because there's one of the vitamins in either the cucumber or the tomato is not absorbed because of that reaction. Is that true?
I have absolutely no idea. I know that one of my favorite things to work with when I'm putting recipes together is a book you have talked about on this program before, The Flavor Bible. And you've got tomatoes and cucumbers are a classic pairing. Now, whether or not that's canceling out vitamins, I really couldn't say. I tell you what, I'll do some digging, and I'll get back to Rob and Veronica on that.
Well, and you know, I've seen food combining charts. You're not supposed to eat X with Y, and looking at it for about 2 minutes, I thought, you know what? I'm not going to remember this. I'm not going to post the chart in my kitchen. So I never dug deep enough to see if there's actually anything to it, if that's a real deal. So, but I will say taste-wise, I mean, some tomatoes and cucumber on a sandwich,
it's
a little
so
mayo,
it's wonderful.
Cheese,
yeah.
Maybe.
It's one, and of course, the cucumber, you've talked about how fragrant they are, and there's that lovely floral, the sweetness to it. Tomatoes have the same thing. There is a flowery note to their aroma, but of course they're going to have more of the acid. So you've got your soft, squishy, acidic tomato and that lovely, crunchy cucumber. I mean, that's summer right there.
Maybe we can throw this one to Dr. Zorba sometime and see if he can weigh in. Judge Zorba can weigh in on the tomato-cucumber combining controversy of 2015.
But no matter what he says, I'm going to eat them together.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Just
yeah,
to be clear.
Yeah.
There
All
you
right.
go.
Let's go back to the callers. And thanks for the question, Janine. We're going to go back to Dennis now in Marathon. Hi, Dennis.
Hello.
Hi, how do you like to eat cucumbers?
We started using it as a bread substitute. We hollow out the middle, and then you put whatever type of condiments, and then your meat. And lettuce.
Awesome. Thanks for that, Dennis. I've seen this actually online, especially when people are pursuing low-carb diets.
Yep. That's, like I say, I got started by using thin slices of cucumber as substitutes for crackers when you're passing appetizers. And that's the
They're
reason.
They're crunchy, but is it really as satisfying as a cracker?
Yes, it
really?
Is.
Really?
Yes, it really, really is.
I'm a cracker person.
So am I, but they are just as good. It's just different, that's all.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Lori Skelton about cooking with cucumbers. You can join in with your suggestions or questions at 800-642-1234. Now, Lori, I said the word cooking, and one of the first things you did for us here was sautéed cucumbers. Tell us about that. And I liked it. So tell us what went into that.
Almost nothing. I thought, okay, yeah, you can do it, but it's probably not going to taste very good. I was surprised at how good a sautéed cucumber is. Mm-hmm. You peel them, you quarter them, you know, just chop them roughly, sauté them in a little bit of butter. I added salt, white pepper, and fresh grated nutmeg, but you, again, can use something a little spicier if you want. You've got this done in 5 minutes, and it's a lovely little side dish. When I made them at home, we had them with things that were off the grill. And I think it does lend itself well to a grilled protein as a side dish. But very, very easy. You're breaking down just enough of that outer skin. Well, not even the skin, but the outer part of the cucumber. While it still is a little bit crunchy on the inside, it's softened up just enough on the outside to make it interesting. I was really surprised. Julia Child has a recipe for baked cucumbers in Mastering the Art of French Cooking. She chops them up, tosses them with salt, sugar, vinegar. She bakes them with butter and herbs. She recommends them alongside with roasted or sautéed chicken or roast veal, or if you're into this sort of thing, sautéed brains and sweetbreads.
I'm not.
Okay. You lost us with that. But actually, that sounds compelling. You know, usually baking things makes them a little less bitter, but I don't know, the cucumber, it's an interesting treatment. I'd try it.
And the one thing that I'm going to try this weekend, apparently you can dredge cucumbers in cornmeal and fry them just like fried green tomatoes.
Wow.
Okay.
And I could see where that would be a really great accompaniment to a BLT.
Back to a caller. We've got Mike on the line in Waukesha now. Mike, hi.
Hi. Because I got introduced to Hendrick's Gin, I now like cucumber in gin and tonics. If you don't want to pay the extra price for Hendrick's. I've done it a couple of ways. You either do... you can do a garnish, but you don't really get much flavor out of that. But if you are doing other things with your cucumber, for example, you can take some of the seed mash if you're doing any of those kind of preparations, and that can be mixed in directly with the gin and tonic, and it adds another flavor to the gin and tonic. It's really good stuff.
Mike, thanks a lot. Great suggestion.
Absolutely. If you don't have time to infuse a bottle, and you've got some of that, as you call it, cucumber guts, and you don't mind the seeds, that's a great way to use up that leftover cucumber.
Now, Laura, you brought some cucumbers and some sprinkly stuff into the studio. There's got to be a better word. What is it?
Okay.
These
are spice mixes. Two of the most common, if you're going to sprinkle on just a plain plate of sliced cucumbers. I mentioned cucumbers are always good with heat. We've got a bottle of what Taijin, the Mexican company, calls fruit seasoning, which is chili pepper, salt, and dehydrated lime juice.
It smells great.
And then we also have Togarashi, which is Japanese. It's a combination of red and black pepper, black and white sesame seeds, ground ginger, powdered seaweed, a little bit of roasted orange peel, and all you need to do is just start with something spicy on a simple plate and then get creative from there.
Doesn't get much easier. Lori, thanks as always.
Absolutely. Enjoy. This is one that we'll be enjoying while the temperature is definitely over 90.
That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies, with us to talk about cucumbers for this Food Friday. Remember to check out that great cucumber recipe, a soup you serve in cucumber cups, served cold. It's over at the Central Time Facebook page.